Hello, this is Pastor Warren Hoyt, and I want to welcome you again to today's podcast. We're going to look at chapter 11 of Pastor Timothy Keller's book, Making Sense of God, today. The title of this chapter is It Reasonable to Believe in God? In this kind of last section of his book, Pastor Keller is going to stop just dealing with secular worldviews for a little bit, and he's going to focus just on the Christian worldview and give sort of a positive defense or explanation of the Christian faith. Because throughout the book up to this time, he's been discussing secular views of things, and now he wants to just make sure he presents the Christian case. And so he reiterates here what he said at the beginning, that contrary to what a lot of secularists believe, secularism isn't just, quote, common sense, unquote, or, quote, what every rational person just knows, unquote. You know, that's kind of what secularists think. They think that their thinking, their way of thinking, is just what everybody knows, and it's just common sense. But what Keller's constantly showing us here in his book is that secularism is actually a belief system, the same as any religion or any other kind of system. It's not simply the absence of faith. On the contrary, it requires its own kind of faith. Same kind of idea that Dr. Frank Turek has in his book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. He presents the same basic thesis, you know. Secularism is its own kind of faith. And if a person says, for example, you have to prove God to me, Keller has shown us in this book that they're really just buying into a form of rationality that most philosophers today consider naive. You can't prove God. You can't prove secularism either. You can't prove it. You have to have faith in these, in both of these systems. It's just, which system do you think makes more sense? And so that's what Keller does in this book. That's what he did in his first book, The Reason for God, as well. He kind of compares and contrasts these two different systems of thinking and believing. I like these questions that he asks. He says, which of these systems, you know, secularism or faith in God, Christianity, which of these systems makes the most sense of our experience, of things we know and things we need to explain? Which one makes the most sense of our social experience and addresses the problems we face in living together? Which system is most consistent? Which of these views of reality makes the most sense emotionally, culturally, and rationally? Now, in this book, Keller looked at six givens to human life, things that he says we can't live without. And I think most of us would agree there are things we can't live without: meaning, satisfaction, freedom, identity, hope, and justice. He looked at each of those, and in each case, he showed that there are competing narratives. There's a secular and a Christian way to understand these things and to address these needs. The secular narratives sometimes offered some truth, some partial truth. But what Keller's been trying to show us here is that the secular view is not as self-evident as their proponents might think or hope. And in fact, the secular view is attended by a lot of different difficulties. And so Keller has contrasted secular views with what Christianity offers. And he's shown the Bible's explanation of the issues and the answers faith in God presents. He showed how Christ offers a meaning that suffering can't remove, a satisfaction not based on circumstances, a freedom that doesn't hurt but rather enhances love, an identity that doesn't crush you or exclude others, a moral compass that doesn't turn you into an oppressor, and a hope that can face anything, even death. So now, in these last chapters, he wants us to have kind of a quick overview of the Christian faith, as he puts it, from 30,000 feet, so to speak, so that we can see why he thinks Christianity is rationally warranted. Now, it's only a quick outline. It's kind of an introduction to Christianity. It's at the tail end of his book. So, you know, he makes that clear. And, of course, if people are really interested, they want to know, listen, there's a world of resources out there to take you deeper. And I myself have other podcasts and other teachings that I can share with you about these things. Many, many books I could recommend, and so on. And so can Keller. But he launches in here to give this presentation of Christian faith. And he begins by asking, why believe in God? And so what he wants to do here is he wants to talk about why he thinks it's rational to believe in God. And he wants to present some of the best reasons for faith. So it's just an overview. So he goes only very briefly, and I'm going to be briefer still as I go over his main points. Like I say, there's tons of stuff out there you can find to amplify every one of these points and give you a greater understanding. But the first thing he begins with is the very existence of the universe. You know, lots of people deal with this today in the realm of apologetics and reasons for faith and so forth. But back in the early 20th century or before that, early in the 20th century, most physicists came to the conclusion that the universe had a beginning. Before that, they kind of bought into the Aristotelian theory that the universe was eternal. But they came to see in the early 20th century that the universe had a beginning. And really, that was a huge, huge development. It's rather mind-boggling because it means that everything around us somehow came to exist out of nothing. And so if a person doesn't believe in the supernatural or in miracles, they've got a real problem. Because the fact is that the universe itself is the biggest miracle ever. And it's staring all of us right in the face. Nobody can escape this reality. Everything that exists today came into being suddenly from nothing. And so as Dr. Frank Turek says in his book, that means that something outside time, space, and matter must have brought time, space, and matter into existence. And actually that something has to be a someone, and it's the someone we call God, because no mere force makes a decision to create. So the creator had to be a person. That's a powerful argument for the existence of God, and no atheist has ever been able to answer it. They think they have. They talk about the multiverse, you know, where, well, maybe this universe came from another universe. And well, we just say, well, where did that universe come from? Well, that came from another universe. Okay, so where did that one come from? You have an infinite regress, but eventually you gotta come to the realization that everything came from nothing. And let me tell you, that's pretty much a miracle, okay? And even some atheist physicists, astrophysicists and so forth, have said that it's supernatural. It's beyond nature. And so that's the first argument. You have the original uncaused cause that brought the universe into existence. And then Keller goes into many of the other arguments or evidences for God. The evidence of design, you know, the intricate design of the universe, which is also called the anthropic principle, which it's called that because anthropos is the Greek word for man. And what that principle states is that the entire universe seems to have been calibrated, fine-tuned in order to make advanced life like us possible. And many people have compared it to like a control room, you know, where there are 20 dials that have to be turned and calibrated to the exactly right setting in order for life like us to exist. And what would be the chances that all those factors could come about by coincidence? Well, it's just not very likely. It's like, you know, could a person win roulette 10 times in a row? Well, yeah, maybe mathematically it's possible, but I'll guarantee you in Las Vegas, if somebody wins 10 times at roulette, security's gonna be called because management's not gonna believe in such a coincidence. And so it can't be a coincidence, you see. And then another argument is the moral argument. And we looked at that in chapter 9. But the point is just that many, you know, almost everybody recognizes within themselves that they have moral feelings. They have a sense of moral obligation. And everybody just knows right and wrong exist. And relativists who say they don't believe in that will prove their hypocrisy if you do something wrong to them. Because if you attack them or rob them or mistreat them, they're going to complain and say, you've done wrong to me. So they may not, they say they don't believe in right and wrong, but everybody knows there's right and wrong. Everybody knows the Holocaust was evil. And so where does that sense that we have come from? It makes sense to have moral law if there's a moral lawgiver. God. It doesn't make sense if the universe is just a big accident with only natural causes, and that's Keller's point. And then, of course, as we saw in chapter 10, Keller goes on to talk about, because of that, you know, there's also no basis for human rights in the secular worldview. If rights don't exist out there, so, objectively somehow in the universe, or, you know, but if they're just made up by the majority, then they're not really rights and you can't really defend them. Our Declaration of Independence says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. It makes sense if there's a creator, but it only makes sense if there is that kind of a real objective authority for human rights, and that authority can only be God. I like what Keller points out here in this book and also in his former book, that nature is, quote, red in tooth and claw, unquote. And really, when you just look around, you don't see a natural self-evident reason for human rights. Because, you know, if you believe in evolution, for example, you believe in the survival of the fittest. So why then should the strong respect the weak? Why should weak people, elderly or children or those who have disabilities and so forth, why should they have any rights at all? On the secular worldview, they shouldn't. They don't. Rights only make sense if we're created by God, if there's a God who gives us the rights. And then the next argument Keller presents is the argument of consciousness. And that's an area of difficulty for secularists. Because what is consciousness? You know, what are we as human beings? Are we just the result of electrochemical reactions in our brains? You know, this one scientist that Keller quotes, he's basically said that. Your hopes, dreams, values, love, all that kind of stuff that you feel, it's really just the result of your genes. It's your molecules, you know, causing you to feel those things. And so that's the purely secular view. But most people just instinctively know that there's got to be more to it than that. We sense within ourselves that life has meaning and worth. We perceive beauty. We experience love. If all those things are just chemical reactions, how do we even know they're real? I mean, you know, how do we explain that? How do we explain choice? Maybe everything we do and everything we are is just determined by chemistry and genetics. Criminals, dictators, you know, Hitler and all guys like that, they're not really bad because they didn't have a choice about doing evil. Their genes made them do it. Hardcore materialists actually try to, you know, maintain this, but even they don't really live like it's true. How is it that we're conscious of ourselves? No one can explain our thoughts, how they come into being or how they function. We know what areas of the brain light up, so to speak, when we're experiencing certain mental states, but nobody can enter into our thought world and perceive what we perceive or explain what makes us who we are. All of this kind of stuff, you see, this consciousness argument that Keller's making, all of this makes more sense in a world created by a spiritual being who created us as conscious spiritual beings like himself. A God of love, a God who is personal. He made us in his image. It makes sense in that kind of a worldview. It doesn't make sense. Consciousness doesn't make sense in a purely materialistic secular worldview. And then Keller talks about the argument from reason, which is related to what we just talked about. Because if we reason only because we evolved to reason in order to survive, you know, survival of the fittest, so the people who reason survived, then reason itself is just the function of the genes and so forth, and it makes it suspect. And, you know, what do you mean we reasoned and the people who reasoned survived? Well, the animal kingdom doesn't reason, and they survived. Why did reason develop in human beings if it's not that necessary? But more importantly, if we reason only because our genes cause these electrochemical reactions, how do we know anything we perceive or reason about is even real? Maybe we're like the people in the movie The Matrix. Remember that movie? They were hooked up to wires and they were in these kind of cocoon things, and the wires fed them information to make it seem like they were living in this world, like our world that we're in, but in fact they were only in cocoons hooked up to wires. If our minds just evolved to come up with the idea of naturalism, materialism, and evolution, then can we really trust our minds? Can we really trust that these concepts of naturalism and materialism and evolution are even real? And more than that, how can we praise good behavior or condemn bad behavior if everyone's just dancing to their genes, as atheist Richard Dawkins so famously said? You know, he's not a hero, this guy. He wasn't a hero. He just did that because he was dancing to his genes. Or this criminal, he's not a bad guy. He couldn't help it. He was dancing to his genes. There's no real choice because everything's determined. Because we just evolve this way and we're just physical beings. We're not spiritual. We don't have consciousness. We don't have choice. We don't have the power of reason. And so that's a strong argument. And then the next one he deals with is beauty. And Keller says, you know, beauty is another thing that gives evidence for God rather than secularism. Because why do we recognize and appreciate beauty in art, nature, music, poetry, all that kind of thing? Some materialists even go so far as to say we appreciate beautiful nature because, well, you know, we instinctively knew that beautiful places would have more food. And so we evolved this love of natural beauty because it helped us to survive. Or like if we appreciate a beautiful body, like a man appreciates a beautiful female body, well, that's just because that would enhance our reproductive instincts and enable us to survive. But I just say, and you know, Keller says in the book, basically, come on, we all know there's beauty that's inexplicable out there. Like there's beauty in a desert, but that's not the best place for you to survive. There's beauty in a storm. Why do we see beauty? Why does it inspire us? The beauty that when we look at the stars or certain beautiful music or poetry, it has nothing to do with survival. In fact, in nature, you often see beauty that's contrary to survival instincts. Why would the bird of paradise, for example, be so beautiful? Have you ever seen videos or pictures of those, the birds of paradise in the tropics? They're fabulously beautiful, and they have all these brightly colored feathers, you know, that are just fantastically artistic, really. And why would a bird evolve those kind of brilliant colors and all when actually they draw attention to the bird? Wouldn't it be better for birds to evolve as camouflaged and dull? Of course it would. Well, then why are they beautiful? Why is there beauty? It doesn't make sense. Neither the existence of beauty nor our appreciation of it makes sense in a secular atheistic worldview, but it makes perfect sense when you understand that the heavens declare the glory of God, as Psalm 19 says. God, after all, he's unimaginably beautiful. He's the most beautiful being in all of creation, in all of the universe. And he's beautiful in his nature, beautiful in his being. And so he is the maker of all the beauty we see around us. He made us in his image, so we appreciate beauty. It's not just utilitarian. It's part of the nature of God, the creator. And so all of creation exists as a manifestation of that, of his beauty, of his glory. It makes perfect sense in a Christian worldview. It doesn't make sense in an atheistic, secular, materialistic worldview. And so this is just chapter 11, and Keller presents these in a very brief fashion. And he says right there, as we all do, that these arguments, they're not absolutely conclusive. They don't prove God. They don't force everybody to believe. But what he's saying here is that cumulatively, many arguments, you see, there's just a lot of them. And if you look at all of them, together they make it more rational to believe in God than to believe in the secular worldview. It takes actually less faith to believe in God. And you know, than it does to believe that, I mean, everything happened by chance. We're all just cosmic accidents of biochemistry. Instinctively, deep in our souls, we know that's not true. You know, I think most of us know we're not just accidents. We have meaning, we have purpose. When we love, it's real. You know, when we appreciate beauty and so forth, we know that it just makes more sense. The secular worldview doesn't. And it really isn't all that self-evident as secularists think. It isn't just common sense as they think. It isn't the best explanation for life and the universe around us. In fact, it just doesn't adequately explain far too many things. So what's the point? What should be done about that? I love this long quote from Keller. I'll finish by reading this. He says, "If your premise that there is no God leads most naturally to conclusions you know are not true, that moral obligation, beauty, and meaning, the significance of love, our consciousness of being a self are illusions, then why not change the premise? Ultimately, non-belief in God is an act of faith because there's no way to prove that the world and all that is within it and its deep mathematical orderliness and matter itself all simply exist on their own as brute fact with no source outside of themselves. If the theory that God exists leads us to expect what we find, whereas the belief there is no God does not, why not move ahead, at least tentatively, by adopting the theory that God is there?" Very wise words. So the key takeaway in this chapter, belief in God is actually quite rational. And so Keller has presented the case for faith in God in a general sort of way. Next chapter, he's going to look at evidence for Jesus Christ specifically. So I hope you'll join me for that discussion, because I think this is very valuable for us to ponder and to really learn and get a hold of. I hope you'll join me next time. Till then, my prayer is that the Lord would richly bless you.